Welcome back to Sparkwood in 21, a No Ship Network Twin Peaks podcast. Today, we are discussing John Bernardi's feedback on the access guide to the town. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
Okay, so first things first, we're going to just give you a quick rundown of what we've been up to lately, and then also what we have planned for Sparkwood in 21 in the near future. We've been covering other shows. I think a lot of the other Twin Peaks podcasts cover exclusively Twin Peaks. I'm not really so sure about that, but I know some of them that I listen to, that's all they cover. But mm-hmm. We're podcasters as a hobby, and we have other shows that we are interested in. So we divide our time up among other shows. And as a lot of you probably already know, because we have mentioned them, but it's Vikings. Sadly, Penny Dreadful's ended, but we were covering Penny Dreadful, and that's what we just finished. And we also have Ash versus Evil Dead coming up. Last year, we produced a lot of podcasts for Twin Peaks, more than we actually initially set out to do. I think we just thought that it was going to be just a project between Steve and I, because Paul wasn't involved. We were doing it at the same time as we were doing other shows, and so we've had to pull back a little bit. You know, we found out what our boundaries were, what we could withstand as far as, you know, working jobs and having
just general life outside of the podcasting sphere.
Responsibilities.
Yeah, anything that has to do with being a living, breathing human being, not in front of a microphone talking right. about stuff that we really love.
I don't know if people really know how much work goes into a podcast, but it's not just sitting down to record it. You also have preparation that goes into it, which, you know, we like to do recaps, as you know, and that requires research as well as sitting down to actually type up every written word that we say. And also, there's the editing. For every hour that we talk, it's going to take me about an hour and a half, if not more, to edit that hour. So that's something to keep in mind. So if you guys are thinking, oh, you guys are just sitting talking in front of the mic, I don't know why you can't like just cover whatever. It's not that way. Not for us. I know it's lame to make excuses, but I felt like I needed to.
Well, you know, we went really above and beyond because we started off and we did the main body of Twin Peaks. We knocked out one a week for as long as it took to get through both seasons. Then we did the movie. Then we did the missing pieces. Then we did people's feedback. And then I'm missing something here. I know.
Interviews
after that, you know, which was kind of that was late last year or
February.
Early this year. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, now, you know, we also went, we did Laura Palmer's diary. We did Dale Cooper's diary. We did, the trading cards, you know, yeah. I mean, and so this is kind of like the last stone uncovered right here, I think, as far as
the books, yeah,
is the book, as far as the books are concerned, this is the last little piece of something that we have to cover of original material from the golden era, as we'll just refer to it, of Twin Peaks, because of course we've got the new book coming up. That's going to be covered extensively whenever we both, you know, sink our teeth into that. So, but needless to say, both Em and I are glad to be back on the Sparkwood in 21 train.
We're rusty. We haven't been in Twin Peaks, you know, thinking about it or involved in it in a while. So I think this is a very appropriate way of getting back in, is actually covering the access guide to the town. So thank you, John, for providing this opportunity for us. But before we get started, just to let you know what's coming up, we are going to do coverage of Lost Highway feedback. We have received some feedback on Lost Highway, and if anybody else wants to contribute, that is due by July 20th. We've actually had a couple of people ask us about that. So if you want to participate, July 20th is the deadline to get your Lost Highway feedback in. And then after that, we're going to work on Wild at Heart, and we will be doing that with Paul again. So I can't give you a date on that one. It's hard to coordinate with Paul sometimes, but but we will be getting that this summer, out this summer. Also, we're going to do a miscellaneous feedback roundup, because I've got some miscellaneous feedback. Even there was more that John had provided attached to this access guide. We could not cover all of that in one fell swoop. So we're just going to use what he wrote in a later podcast regarding that. And a lot of it's feedback in response to the interviews we did back in February. Okay, so anything else?
No, I think you covered it all.
Okay. All right, so let's get into discussing Twin Peaks, An Access Guide to the Town, which was written by David Lynch, Mark Frost, and Richard Saul Werman. And who is this Richard Saul Werman guy? Let's see.
Isn't that just Bob's pen name? He helped him.
I'm just looking to see what else he's written. Some access guides to San Francisco and Rome. So he must be someone who is really well versed in writing access guides. So even to Paris, he's written a book called Information Anxiety. I have that. Anyway, so let's get to John's feedback. All right, John Bernardi says, so here we are, Twin Peaks, an access guide. The book is a partnership between Twin Peaks Productions and Access Press, a genuine publisher of actually real city travel guides. The credits say that the writing came from de facto showrunners Robert Engels and Harley Payton, show writer Trisha Brock and Greg Almquist, and Lisa Friedman, who I believe came from the Access Press side. It's an entertaining book for the deep divers like myself, and otherwise is a fun work that you should look at if you're interested in or in the middle of the world-building side of writing. It has sections covering history, the Packard Sawmill, flora, fauna, geology, and weather, points of interest, events, dining, lodging, sports, fashion, religious, worship, transportation, town life, and government. While it's got a tongue-in-cheek goofiness throughout the book, similar in tone to the screwball stuff in the Dale Cooper autobiography, it is much more welcome in this book because the eccentric tone is more genuine and believable when talking about the town where the log lady and Nadine Hurley live. John says he really digs this book, and he's glad to hear Daniel likes it too, but it seems like this book came and went without too many other people noticing it, possibly because of that bland front cover, but probably more so because it was released when the show was deep into second season. Based on the handwritten note on page one from Mayor Milford, the book was published on April 7th of 1991, which means the Owl Cave petroglyph was just revealed, and in a couple of days, we were going to see Gordon Cole meet Shelley for the first time. Not that this book is tied into any story relevance, I'm just pinning it to the timeline for a point of reference.
So whenever we discuss stuff like this, it always makes me wonder if, like John says, it came and went, you know, without much fanfare. If it had been published these days, it probably wouldn't have been published. It would have been posted online. It would have been something that you could go, it would have been a website and you could go to and have interactive maps and histories running on a sidebar and stuff like this. So it just makes you wonder if people at the time were kind of ignoring this because it was second season and it was in the doldrums, or if it was just not something that people were into. Like,
I think it would still be published because, I mean, Penny Dreadful just came out with their companion book. I think there's actually more of an audience for that kind of thing. So maybe it would actually get more fanfare these days. And we have the things like Twitter and Facebook that would help promote something like that, because, you know, we have those outlets now for people who are, you know, avidly interested in things like that, that can discover that kind of thing. Where back in the 90s, I mean, if, you know, depending on where you lived, it depends on, you know, their store's inventory, if they bothered to get something like that. And, if you grew up on a military base like we did at that time overseas, I mean, you know, if your chances of discovering something like that depends on your environment, really.
Yeah, and you had to rely on word of mouth a lot of times, unless you saw an advertisement in a magazine. And then if you, like you said, inventory at a particular store, I don't know how many times I had went to a brick and mortar store in the 90s because that's all you had and they didn't have it. And then you go through that whole rigmarole of trying to order it and it takes forever. Sometimes it doesn't come in and you're calling, bugging these clerks and half of them don't know what you're talking about. And it's a mess. So you're right. I guess I'm just cynical about, you know, the dying book culture that we have. So I just feel like something, if it came out now, I guess what I'm trying to say is it would be more popular, but it would probably be a website instead of a
digital
book.
Release.
Yeah. But then again, I think the Twin Peaks crowd would be they'd be more accepting of a book than they would a website. So I guess that you're right.
You would get both.
Yeah.
So, and I also think it's interesting that, you know, not only is John pointed it out, this is an interest to a Twin Peaks fan, but maybe somebody who's, you know, a budding author, somebody who wants to look into something as far as how you world build an imaginary place. I think that's an interesting point. But John goes on to say, the cover's got a front and center picture of a mediocre slice of cherry pie on a white plate over a green background, and the town name is solid red letters instead of the usual outlined green and brown type. Honestly, the cover is the worst part of the whole book. The pie looks like some of the plastic food my boys throw over the baby gate all the time, and I'm looking at it right here. Oh, I've eaten a pie that looks like that. It might not have been the greatest pie in the world, but I have. Let's see.
There's a whole like art form to making fake food look real. Yeah, people know about it. You know, when you see scoops of ice cream, it's butter, and you know, things of that nature. So And that was around back then for sure. So that pie actually looks real, but because we're so used to seeing fake food passed off as real food that it looks less appetizing. So it's kind of a paradox.
John says, I don't think I'd be too interested in that pie, and I'm sure it's not Norma's recipe. Thankfully, the book improves immediately on the inside front where we see a roadmap of the town with all of our favorite spots listed. And some Ungwen's, I hope I'm saying that right, field observatory, for example, that could have made for some interesting scenes had it been used in the show. If you look long enough, you can find details like how you can probably see the gazebo from the sheriff's station. Therefore, when Ski Mask Leland heart attacks Dr. Jacoby in the back, the night shift version of Deputy Andy could have said that could hurt somebody if he was looking out the window. Well.
I don't know what's funnier, though. The idea of somebody saying that could hurt somebody or a night shift version of Andy, who's just that we never got to meet. Because I was just always had the impression that they closed up at 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening and they were done. Well, you know. The sheriff and Andy go home, and then Hawk actually hangs out and does the real work, and then, you know, we go from there.
John goes on to say, there are details in the margins throughout the book, sometimes pertinent artifacts or wildlife, and sometimes profiles of characters on the show. The profiles use and then elaborate on the same biographical material that is written on the character's trading card. I'll keep a tally of these as I go. I should also mention all through the book, there are small advertisements for made-up companies that add color to the town. The ads are mostly goofy and play for smiles because they are not strong enough to get a true laugh. I agree with that. The Did You Know page of Random Statistics at the front explains there was a census error and corrects the town population from 51,201 listed on the town sign to 5,120, like Lynch and Frost wanted in the first place, thus making it much more reasonable that the town needs a traveling judge rather than being able to support its own, and puts the smaller town size officially into canon.
That makes a lot of sense, because I know I've thought about it in the past, and I don't know if we talked about it on one of our previous podcasts, but that seems like a pretty big size town to have that small town mentality.
Yeah, the network, I believe, is the one that pushed for the higher number.
Because, I mean, when we lived in Boise, I think the population at the time was like 150,000 and change. So you figure Boise's like a city the size of Boise, which isn't really that huge or anything, but to have only three times the size of Twin Peaks, you would think it would be like 6, 7, 8, 10 times bigger.
John now goes on to say, also in the early pages, there's a weird note from Andrew Packard's will that says upon his death, he wanted a travel guide of the town created. So there's our framing device for how and why this book exists. Kind of a weak premise, especially after it also acknowledges within its own pages that Packard's still alive after all. But I guess they wanted to use a picture of Dan O'Herlihy to show the current generation and possibly last in name of Packard, seeing as they go into the founders of the Twin Peaks next. Twin Peaks started in the 1890s when James and Ungwen Packard moved from Boston, bought land, and built the Packard Mill. Rudolph and Pixie Martell moved from St. Louis a year later, and through a series of bad luck and worse timing, accidentally ended up in Twin Peaks as well. Martell used the very last of his money to start a mill of his own, and here he begins the rivalry. While the Packards and Martells duked it out, Oroville and Brulitha Horn moved in, started a general store, likely burned down its only competition, and became the mercantile outlet in the area. The next generation of Packards beat out the Martells, and so the Packard Mill assimilated the other. But then in the family's third generations, Catherine marries the last Martell, Pete. So when Andrew died, in quotations, and then Josie, who had her picture and brief bio in the margin feature here, died too, the Packard name died out first, and the Martell name will die with Pete and Catherine, so victory goes to the Horns for being the last founding family name standing. Unless, of course, there's random illegitimate Packard children running around in Asia that will make an appearance in the new episodes, which I totally expect.
Oh, geez. Of all the plot lines that I would be less interested in, I really can't think of it. I'm just hoping it doesn't happen. That's all I'm saying. That's my 2 cents for that. Sorry.
It just depends how they spin it.
Yeah. I mean, I have faith in the writers. They could make pretty much anything seem interesting if you're going to put it in the Twin Peaks world, hopefully.
John says, adding feedback of my own, I notice here how once again a representative from Boston beats down the one from St. Louis, so it's one more time like those asshole Patriots literally stealing one from the Rams, or the actually talented Red Sox taking down the Cardinals twice. Not even in fiction can we get a break from that town.
Wow. My family's from the Northeast, so I'm not a sports fan at all, but if I was, I'd be a Pats and Sox fan, so I can't comment on this. It's conflict of interest.
Moving on then. So there's a section for the old opera house next, and has Ben Horn in the margin because they say he renovated and reopened the then abandoned building. We see Catherine in the margin of the Packard sawmill section, along with some details of saw blades. The book acknowledges the mill has burned down and has plans in the works to rebuild, but doesn't share any actual plans. Dale Cooper is in the margin of the whittling section. Yes, there's a section specifically on whittling, directly across from a graphic of two hands missing a total of three fingers and text stating the minimum number of fingers needed for whittling is 7. This book is all about that kind of sense of humor. The next page talks about the woman who picks which wood is turned into what product at the Packard Mill. Woodmistress, Helga Brogger. I only mention her because of part of her quote is this. It runs in the family, women of vision, the backbone of Twin Peaks. The florist section is where they put supposed nature lover Dr. Jacoby's margin feature, as well as Deputy Hawks, the log ladies, and Margaret's log itself, a ponderosa pine. I suspect this is also the area most written by the actual Access Guide writers because the plants and ecosystem are talked about in a mostly realistic way. Same goes for the fauna section, except they do include the pine weasel, as well as two legends, the Native American origin of the owl, and a sad one about a white moose that I pretty well liked. Pete Martell's margin feature is next, along with some fishing advice over multiple pages that Pete typed up for us. You can see what Truman's farewell present to Cooper, a green butt skunk, looks like on a pictorial looks like on a pictorial list of lures. And there's a mention of a Dominic Renault, seemingly the area's closest thing to a Davy Crockett. So we know that the Renaults are a multi-generational fixture as well. So Cooper's arrival signaling their endangered status could actually mean something to this town. Also, a fun detail, anywhere else owls harmonize in thirds. In Twin Peaks, they harmonize in diminished sevenths.
I don't know enough about music notes. Well, I'll be honest, I don't know anything about musical notes to understand what the import of that could possibly be. But diminished sevenths sounds really cool. Like, that'd be a great metal band name, the diminished sevenths. Or maybe a power metal band, they could be the undiminished sevenths. But whatever.
Well, just out of curiosity, I looked up the diminished seventh chord. It's commonly used in the harmony of both Western classical music and also in jazz and popular music of the 20th and 21st centuries. Classical composers of the 18th and 19th centuries imaginatively exploited the chord's dramatic and expressive potential. So apparently, Schoenberg had wrote about the diminished seventh. Whenever one wanted to express pain, excitement, anger, or some other strong feeling, there we find, and almost exclusively, the diminished seventh chord. That's interesting. This is only happening within Twin Peaks, and you've got these particular things being expressed, pain, excitement, anger, or some other strong feeling.
So basically what we're being told is that if the owls are singing in diminished sevenths, that means that they're conveying the emotion that normal owls don't. So I guess it makes sense for Twin Peaks. Seem to remember owls playing a prominent part somewhere in there, possibly.
So John goes on to say, Big Ed's feature is placed in the margin of the geology section because his gas farm is exactly on the westernmost coast of the country before the volcanic activity happened that forced Whitetail and Blue Pine Mountains into the sky. We find out one of Ed's relatives was a minister during the time of a great snowstorm, and also we got the general temperature of the town as of 1991. Summer is 66 degrees and January is 30 degrees. That sounds perfect.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. Like, where we are, the average temperature throughout the summer is in the low to mid 90s with a heat index pushing you right up over 100 most times, sometimes close to 110. So summer as 66 degrees, I'll take it. Even if January is only 30.
That's not bad.
No, it isn't really.
John says, right in the middle of the book is a 4-page pictorial advertisement for Tim and Tom's Taxidermy, a completely unrealistic company that does taxidermy as well as transportation, which is only noteworthy for its ridiculous length and the fact that Tim is David Lander's Twin Peaks Mr. Pinkle and Laverne and Shirley's Squiggy, and Tom is Greg Feinberg, the Twin Peaks producer as well as producer, writer, and director for such later projects as Carnival, Deadwood, and True Blood.
That's cool.
Right after the ad, we get info on Whitetail Falls and then Owl Cave, complete with a picture of the petroglyph map. Then we get a section on the Grange and the train graveyard. The Grange was the only original building to survive the 1905 earthquake, and it housed the Sheriff's Department, Chamber of Commerce, pretty much everything. Harry's namesake, the future President Truman, even gave a speech on the steps of the Grange. But on December 1st of 1953, it burst into flames and nothing was left in the aftermath. The significance of fire destroying the town's progress is not lost on me, but I can't figure out any buried significance of the date. The best I have is this. It's 6 days after Mark Frost was born, and exactly 1 month before Mary Sweeney was born. Also around this time, the highway system was making trains obsolete, so many of the trains that used to haul lumber for the mill and nowhere else to go except the depot, which turned into their final resting places. The train cars went into disrepair and turned into the perfect place for demonic spirits to enact ritual possession transfers.
It's a known fact. I mean, if you leave a train car alone long enough, demonic spirits will manifest themselves there. That's why they don't do it.
That's why Blaine the Train exists.
Exactly. Blaine the Pain, the mono.
Joking aside, between the burning of the Grange and the death of the train industry, pretty much everything that made Twin Peaks tick besides the mill itself came to a hard stop in the 50s. I'd like to think the writers included this symbolic halt of progress to explain why everything in Twin Peaks leans towards that famously 50s aesthetic. Yeah, that makes sense.
Trapped in time, so to speak.
Next, we have an entry on one single page about the Passion Play. The book makes it sound like it's an avant-garde theater performance that takes place in Glastonbury Grove every 5 or so years. The event takes all night and ends at dawn with sunshine that feels like a victory. It is always about good versus evil, it plays out differently every time, and it's never promoted or announced. Blink and you'll miss it. Also, no one can verify who sponsored the event, though most people think it's the mysterious Bookhouse Boys. I choose to believe that calling the Passion Play a performance is in an on-the-hell-mouth way for the Muggle townsfolk to look the other way while actual demon magic rituals are taking place in their own town, especially if they were to accidentally happen upon the Bookhouse Boys pushing back the darkness in the woods with whatever form of sacrifice or theosophic grail quest they need to employ. So is he saying that the Bookhouse Boys are doing a ritual to keep the darkness in the woods?
Yeah, I think because it only happens every 5 years or so, and it's, I think what John's assuming it to be, and I agree with him, is a sort of a ritual that's put on by the Bookhouse Boys because they know about all this kind of magic to push back against the powers of darkness that are trying to come out of Glastonbury Grove, you know, via the lodge or what have you. And it's done under the guise of a play, so nobody thinks that it's, nobody who's not in the know thinks that this kind of stuff is actually going on.
I like that idea. It's like the 9 3/4 stop at the train at Hogwarts Express. They're not seeing it.
Yeah, it's there, but you're not really seeing it.
Or they're labeling it as something else in their minds so they can deal with it. I like that a lot.
That's actually probably more realistic. Yeah. They're seeing it, but they're not. You can't. But that's how humans cope with stuff, isn't it? That's how we deal with things. We label them in a way that we can accept and understand. And then we file it away in our system so everything stays in an orderly fashion. John goes on to say, the revealed details are as follows. In Ghostwood National Forest, there's a circle of 12 Douglas firs. Note a larger, older circle than the sycamores in the show. Shortly after dark, a half a dozen cassocked figures emerge, bearing the sword, chrysanthemum, crucifix, and chalice. Then, from no visible origin or for any understandable purpose, the mysterious guardian appears at the gate, whatever that may mean. I suspect this guardian is either the person bearing the sword for Truman in the episode 29 script, or it is the giant, but that's just me shooting blind. Probably what the writers were thinking was that the guardian was the hooded figure whose silhouette is at the front of the TV episode when Major Briggs is on a throne explaining what is likely his lodge trial experience, and therefore the TV show is definitely seeding the mystery play to be a big part of the next season's first big story arc. That sounds hopeful. That sounds more hopeful than Packard's Asian children to be honest. I would rather have this avenue explored. The book says that the next play is scheduled to happen in April of 1992, which in our time would coincide with when season 3 would have aired, but in Twin Peaks time would have been about 3 full years away. I'm going to assume the book plays loose with in-continuity time the same way Laura's diary entries are dated 1 year later than the TV show said they happened, making it more in line with when viewers experience the story. This assumption makes Access Guide April or 1992 translate to TV show April of 1989. That means a mystery play would begin 5 to 10 episodes from the season 2 finale, perfectly timed to rescue Cooper. Of the characters with margin features, these are the people who note the passion play in their list of bests: Pete Martell, Ed Hurley, Doc Hayward, Harry Truman, blatantly not mentioning the passion play at all, Bookhouse Boy James Hurley. Interesting. Yeah, I've always wondered about that. Like, he's kind of like the shining example of the Bookhouse Boy. He's the one who we always get the most of, right? So,
isn't he like the prospect?
Yeah, because he's younger. But I mean, we get more screen time with him than anybody else. So maybe he's like a junior varsity member of the Bookhouse Boys. Mm-hmm. And then whenever he, I would say, graduated or dropped out of school, whichever one, but he just kind of leaves. So that's up in the air. It's possible they didn't want him just because he is who he is. But all right. Up next is a boatload of pages covering the Packard Timber Games, which happens a half mile north of your podcast intersection every August. Men in kilts compete in events like the Cabber Toss, High Climbing, and Hawk's Bag, Bury the Hatchet. In the margin, you can learn how to hang an axe. The calendar of events is next. Twin Peaks has an annual chess tournament, a huge 4th of July deal, a Magi pageant in the winter, and instead of St. Patrick's Day, Twin Peaks has the Caribou Festival, where people dress up in the fur of dead animals and try their best imitations of a caribou mating call.
Pass.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds kind of fun, but I think St. Patty's Day is a little bit more my thing. Maybe this is why Catherine and Josie are into fur coats.
I don't think so.
The only continuity issue I noticed on the calendar is that they put Miss Twin Peaks in April, but in the show it was happening late March. A quibble, but it's there.
It's like Easter.
Yeah, it's like...
It can be in March, it can be in April.
It falls on a different date every year. They just can't decide. All right, into the dining section, we get a recipe for cherry pie, which, as not a baker, I can neither confirm nor deny its level of heavenly. Nor can I grade the chocolate donut recipe a few pages later, but we do find out the Wagon Wheel Bakery is the supplier of all those sheriff's office donut spreads where we are treated to in the TV show. We get a list of the Double R's weekly specials, as well as Norma Jennings' margin profile, where it says she has a hallucinatory meatloaf recipe. I find myself pretty darn hungry. Hallucinatory meatloaf recipe. Among other things, the Diner's Jukebox song selections are written out. While there's no Angelo Badalamenti to be seen, you could plunk down some change to play instrumental versions of both Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up and Billy Ocean's When the Going Gets Tough. So apparently in Twin Peaks, you could get Rickrolled.
Rickrolled, and you can Romance the Stone or whichever movie that Billy Ocean... Lame joke, sorry.
With your Caribbean Queen?
Yeah.
Besides the Double R, the book has write-ups for the Great Northern's Timber Room, the Lamplighter Inn, Angelo Wrong's Italy / Thai restaurant, which sounds an awful lot like a real local restaurant by me, Thai Pizza, so I'd try it in a heartbeat. Or if those don't work, it says the Roadhouse is always good for a corn dog. Ew, spiked corn dogs. The margin has a recipe for Eileen Hayward's coffee for a crowd. 40 to 250 servings. And for some reason, this is also the section they decided to put James Hurley's margin feature. I guess these restaurants are all on the open road or something. Or it's where you go when you skip school on your bike. On the page listings all the hotels and inns, there's a character profile that spans into both margins for Trudy Chelgren, Great Northern Employee of the Year. I read somewhere once that the woman pictured is Paula Shimatsu Yu, the show's publicist, but I was dead wrong about that one, and I'm really glad I had a hunch to look into this again before I pulled a Leo in a horse suit. The actual lady in question, it's Jill Engels, Robert Engels' wife. So while Cooper, Doc Hayward, Hawk, and the main characters get features that take up one margin each, the wife of one of the book's authors gets two margins. Sounds like a smart move on the part of smooth motherfucker Bob Engels if I ever heard one. I'll remember this move for sure if I ever publish a book. So sports is next, and they do a game-by-game breakdown of the 68 Steeplejacks' perfect high school football season. They made it sound okay enough, but it reads like the kids played on both offense and defense, which I think they do in high school, but I'm just not sure. Here's all you need to know. Harry was the quarterback, and among his teammates are Big Ed, Hawk, Hank, and Toad. Hank was a gifted star, but a huge troublemaker. You don't say. Therefore, a prototypical diva wide receiver. Ed had steely hands, and Hawk was too small for defense, too slow for offense, yet he got the goddamn job done.
That was like me at softball. They have this picture, which is like set back far enough to where you really can't make out faces, so they can just
for the
say,
high school team.
Yeah, they can just say whoever is whoever here.
The most important victory hung on a 15-minute play where Hawk, blatantly suffering from a concussion, runs the wrong way with the ball and somehow turns it into a score. As long plays usually would be more like 15 seconds, this reminds me of previously noted TV show Chess Issues. Yes, I had a problem with those. Bringing up Hank, another aside, I actually wish Hank Jennings would come back and be menacing in the new episodes, based on how many places he was and how many cookie jars he had his mitts in the last episodes of the first season. But that weak-ass roundhouse kick when Cousin Jonathan slash Mr. Lee takes him down as if he were nothing turned into a weak character on the spot.
See, I call those cute kicks. That was definitely one of those.
And then all that BS Chris Mulkey did to sour Peggy Lipton on him behind the scenes makes Hank dead to me, which is all such a shame. I even like him on the show Grimm as Monroe's dad, but you can't treat your co-stars the way he did and not expect to be written off forever. Yeah, there's really no excuse for that kind of shit. You know, it's just shenanigans. And just you watch. Now that I went out of my way to say something about it, he'll be there in the new episodes like nothing ever happened. But will Peggy Lipton? Next in the book. Okay, so I don't think he'll be back.
I don't remember if he was in the cast list.
But you know, things change. They could have made up somehow. He could have apologized. You know, people let bygones be bygones, especially after 20-year spans of time or more.
Yeah, I don't really feel like that's one to hold a grudge over, especially if somebody apologizes and people go through weird phases and, you know, learn from it, hopefully.
I think part of being an adult is the ability to apologize for something like that and also reciprocally the ability to accept an apology for something like that. So anyway, next in the book, there's a section on fashion, which is silly and skippable, except for that picture of the Horns logo in Art Deco lettering that's so classic it's sexy. And also, there's two pictures side by side, one of Lynch and Frost talking and one of Bobby and James dramatically flanking a totem pole. The only caption written by either picture says, quote, locals. It's an easy gag, but it made me smile. Next up is a section on religious worship where we find out some religious affiliations. The Palmers, Briggs, and Jennings are Lutherans. Hurleys, Pulaskis, and Packards are Catholics. Haywards and Horns are Episcopal. They also note the Theosophist Society, where they note Pete Martell and the Log Lady have made appearances. We also find out the radio stations in town play only country, classic rock, or traffic and weather, classical music if you're lucky. Tom and Tim are the only local transportation service. A rebellious Irish phone operator established the phone book to be alphabetical by first name instead of last name, and no one ever changed it. The names listed here show a lot of Roberts, and the last names are snagged from the creators and staff.
That song that
Ed and Nadine, no, Ed and
Norma were listening to in the Fire Walk With Me cuts
in the car,
yeah, in the truck. I think, I don't think it falls under any of those categories. I don't think it would be on country, class rock, or definitely traffic, but interesting.
Well, they were on the edge of town, so maybe,
yeah, they tuned in,
yeah, they tuned into like the local Seattle,
the diminished sevenths, not where they're harmonizing in thirds.
After that chunk of randomness, we get a page on the Twin Peaks timber players. Doc Hayward's smiling face is in his margin feature, where we creepily find out he's an expert in euthanasia, and we also find out he somehow has enough time to be majorly involved in the theater. Leland and Sarah Palmer started in the troupe in 74, and it's put on three plays a summer since. On the facing page is a section on the Black Lake Cemetery where Leland Palmer's margin feature is located, as well as, I'm sure, him.
Mm-hmm.
Snap. The Twin Peaks Chamber of Commerce comes next and includes an actual budget, where we find out that Miss Twin Peaks brings it in, and where we also find out that they are stupid beyond extravagance with their 4th of July show expenses, and the town should be bankrupt four times over. There's a proposed prison facility for some reason, and the page for that is where they decide to put Harry's margin feature. Why they don't just include a picture of the sheriff's office instead, I'll never know. Maybe they didn't want to have to explain just how many police officers are actually on the force.
Maybe.
Major Briggs never shows up in the margins anywhere, but a letter sent to him asking for material about Ungwin's Field Observatory, which abbreviates to UFO, not a coincidence, for inclusion in this book is returned and heavily blacked out, leaving only these words randomly exposed. Nobody knows the trouble we've caused.
Ooh.
I'm in redacted papers in Twin Peaks. And after that, it's ads for the other Twin Peaks merchandise, production credits, and the inside back cover has a mileage list from Twin Peaks to other cities. North Bend to Seattle is somewhere around 30 miles, I think, but Twin Peaks to Seattle is 256. The back cover displays the same town map as the inside front cover. So, there we have it. Welcome to Twin Peaks, an access guide. Hope you enjoyed the book report, and I hope it left enough room between words for you to do your thing, too. And thanks for hanging in there with this overly gigantic email. I keep thinking I'm going to be able to write smaller emails next time so I'm not hogging so much real estate, but ever since you started giving us at least a month between episodes to gather our thoughts, I can't seem to help myself. Yeah, that's if we just fire them out the whole time, there's not enough time, you know, but when we take a break, then... And he says, John goes on to say, great job again on all the interviews. I still can't quite believe you let me be part of it. And thanks for putting together another episode of my favorite podcast. Take care, John.
Well, thank you, John, for doing this for us, because I wasn't quite sure how I'd be able to cover this, and you solved that. So thank you very much for taking the time to do that. It is a lot of work to sit down and do something like that. So we appreciate it. I know other listeners who are interested in this also appreciate that.
I definitely appreciate it because, like Em said, it takes a lot of work to dive into something like this and make all the pertinent reference points and just kind of organize everything in a way that makes it presentable. You know, because when you're covering a book like that, you either have to approach it one or two ways. You just do this real quick sketch summary that's about a paragraph long and then hope that your talking can flesh the rest out and make it interesting, which is kind of a gambit that doesn't always work. Or you can do it this way where you systematically go through the book, you know, and almost do an outline chapter by chapter and list all of the things that we're going to want to talk about. And that's what John did for us in this instance. So lots of thanks.
So now I feel like I'm dipping my toes back into Twin Peaks, and this was a good way to do it.
Yeah, we're still in the Twin Peaks desert, so to speak, because the book doesn't come out for a little while, and the show's not due until sometime next year. So we're not even sure when or how the delivery method is going to be. I've heard some like conflicting reports about how it's going to play out. Like, is it going to be all at once? Is it going to be...
They haven't announced it. There's no conflicting reports. There just hasn't been any specific report.
I thought you had mentioned something about...
theater releases.
Theater releases, and then the show kind of like airing for 3 or 4 weeks and then taking a break and then coming back at another time.
I don't remember that. But, okay. I've seen where they've talked about possibly releasing some of it in the theaters, but... the only impression I have right now, it's not going to be the typical release. So whatever they have in mind, they have not yet revealed to us.
So something's going to be strange about it because it has to be, because it's Lynch and it's Twin Peaks. He can't do anything the regular way, goddammit. And that's why we love him. But at the same time, it doesn't help us out.
Well, always. As podcasters, it doesn't.
No.
But, you know, that's like the one... upside to Penny Dreadful stopping, like, if, because it's looking like it might even get pushed back into the late spring, early summer. I don't know. Like I said, it's all speculation right now as far as when Twin Peaks season 3 is going to be released. But, you know, if it's at that time, that's perfect for us as podcasters.
Mm-hmm.
So I will not look that gift horse in the mouth. All right. So that's it for now. Anything else you want to say before we...
I would just like to say to everybody who only listens to the Twin Peaks, you know, Spark 21 stuff, hang in there. There's going to be more stuff in the future, but we've been pretty exhaustive about what we've covered. So it's not like there's a whole, like I said earlier, we've pretty much uncovered that last stone. So the next thing up is going to be the book. And then after that, we're going to have to wait until, you know, the show airs. But we are going to be doing some of, like Em had mentioned earlier, some of David Lynch's other works. We plan on covering most of his movies at some point or another in the future. And we're going to be doing the Lost Highways podcast or feedback podcast in the not too distant future. So we'll be there. And, you know, while you're at it, go to our website and check out some of our other podcasts. You never know. You might like the shows. Give it a shot.
And that's at www.noship.net. And again, as a reminder, your feedback for Lost Highway is July 20th. That's the due date.
Professor Deadline. M has spoken. That's your homework. That's your due date.
All right. That's it. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. I'm your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.